Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Feel free to download these audio files and share them with your friends and family. Please consider joining Beth Emmanuel's virtual community and support our efforts for the kingdom by clicking on the support tab at BethEmmanuel.org.
In Revelation chapter 8, we finally get to see the seventh seal opened on the scroll with seven seals. The idea is that each of the seven seals needs to be opened before the scroll can be read, this scroll of redemption. And so far, the opening of each seal has been accompanied by some type of calamity or scourge brought about by the opening of the seal. And in the previous chapters, we've worked through the first six seals already. We're just waiting on the seventh seal. And according to my interpretation and way of understanding this text, the first five seals all refer to things that took place in the first century, either before or contemporary with the writing of the book of Revelation, back in the days of the apostles and the Domitian persecution. In other words, they have already been opened. They've already been accomplished. The sixth seal is the one that we are waiting now on now, and when it's opened, it unleashes the day of wrath, the hidden day of the Lord begins, and that day will be marked by international cataclysms, as it says in Revelation 6, beginning in verse 12, a great earthquake, the sun becomes black as sackcloth, the full moon becomes like blood, the stars of the sky fall to the earth as a fig tree sheds its winter fruit, the sky vanished like a scroll, rolled up, every mountain and island moved from its place, and then the kings of the earth, and the great ones, and the generals, and the rich, and the powerful, and everyone, slaves and free, hid themselves in caves and among the rocks of the mountains, calling to the mountains and to the rocks, fall on us, hide us from the face of him who is seated on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come. This is the day of the Lord. Who can stand? And then we read in Revelation chapter 8, when the Lamb opened the seventh seal, so this is the last seal, when the Lamb opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. To what does this silence refer? I believe it alludes to the daily sacrificial services in the temple on earth, and by extension to the time of daily prayer, which, of course, the daily times of prayer correspond to the time of daily sacrifice. Let me explain. The temple on earth is a reflection of the heavenly temple above. We know this. Nowhere is this principle made clearer than here in the book of Revelation, where we've already seen a heavenly altar corresponding to the altar of burnt offering below. We've already seen the heavenly menorah, seven burning ones, the seraphim burning like torches before the Lord, standing before the Lord, and these correspond to the seven lamps of the menorah burning in the temple below. And we are about to see an altar of incense in the temple above, which corresponds to the altar of incense in the temple below. See, in the temple on earth, the tabernacle, the temple, the hour of incense is connected with the kindling of the menorah and the daily sacrifices. So, for example, we read about this in Exodus chapter 29, where it says, "Now this is what you shall offer on the altar, two lambs a year old, day by day, regularly." This is the daily continual burnt offering, the daily sacrifices. "One lamb you shall offer in the morning." This is Shacharit, the time of morning prayer, the morning sacrifice. "The other lamb you shall offer between the evenings," Bein Ha'eravim, that is at twilight, it says, but we should understand as late afternoon. And this is the evening sacrifice. "And with the first lamb, a tenth seah of fine flour," and so on, and wine with the drink offering and so forth. And with both of these lambs. And it says, "It shall be a regular burnt offering throughout your generations at the entrance of the tent of meeting before the Lord." And then it goes on in Exodus chapter 30, in conjunction with these daily offerings, it goes on, it says, "You shall make an altar on which to burn incense. You shall make it of acacia wood. A cubit shall be its length, a cubit its breadth. It shall be square, two cubits shall be its height. Its horns shall be of one piece with it, and you shall overlay it with pure gold, its top and around its sides and its horns. And so this is the golden altar, unlike the bronze altar of burnt offering that stands in the courtyard of the temple, in the courtyard of the tabernacle. This is the altar that's inside the tabernacle, inside the temple, inside the holy place. It says in verse 6, you shall put it in front of the veil that is above the Ark of the Testimony, in front of the mercy seat that is above the testimony where I will meet with you. And Aaron shall burn fragrant incense on it every morning when he dresses the lamps, he shall burn it. And when Aaron sets up the lamps of the menorah at the evening sacrifice, he shall burn it, a regular incense offering before the Lord, so twice a day. So in the days of the temple, here's what would happen. They would make the daily burnt offering that we just read about. And at the same time, they would tend to the menorah, as we just read. And at the same time, then, the priest, chosen by lot to do so, would take coals from the altar of burnt offering and incense, and he would go into the temple, and he would take these hot coals from the altar of burnt offering. He'd go into the temple, and he'd place these hot coals on the golden altar that stands before the Lord. And then he would pour out two handfuls of finely ground incense over those hot glowing coals and ignite the incense, filling the interior of the temple with a cloud of fragrant smoke. All this time while he's doing this, the daily prayers, the Amidah or its equivalent, would be happening outside at the time of prayer in conjunction with the sacrifice. And this is the prayer that today is recited silently in the synagogue. So in the temple, at the conclusion of these things, the priest would wait quietly for the incensing priest to come back out of the temple so that they could conclude the prayer with the priestly benediction. You remember how they waited for Zechariah, the father of John the Baptist, when he saw the angel Gabriel and they're waiting for him to come out. So outside, as the priest is offering incense inside the temple, the rest of the priests are waiting outside for him to come back so that they can conclude the service with the Aaronic benediction. And I believe that this is the period of silence, which we now remember by the silent Amidah prayer in the synagogue. I believe that this is what we see alluded to here in the book of Revelation, because it's going to be followed by a heavenly incense service on earth as it is in heaven. All right, so then it says in Revelation 8, verse 2, while this silence is still going on, it's going to say, then I saw the seven angels who stand before God, and the seven trumpets were given to them. And this sets us up for the seven trumpets, which are about to break the silence and, you know, break this half hour of silence and commence with the calamities released by the opening of the seventh seal. So it's kind of a room inside a room, a wheel inside a wheel type of thing. You know, we thought that all we needed to do was open the seventh seal, but it turns out once you open the seventh seal, you have to go through seven trumpet blasts. And then you go through the seven trumpet blasts, and once you get through the seven trumpet blasts, it turns out that the seventh trumpet blast signals the start of the pouring out of seven bowls of God's wrath. And that's going to be the structure and order for the rest of the book of Revelation. It's three sequences. Seven seals, but the seventh seal involves seven trumpets. And the seventh trumpet involves seven bowls. Trumpets and shofar blasts already have an eschatological significance in Judaism because of several verses from the prophets about trumpets. And of course, it reminds us of Rosh Hashanah, the festival of trumpets, and all of that high holiday imagery is certainly at work here. We remember that the coming of the Messiah and the resurrection of the dead and the ingathering of Israel are all supposed to be heralded by a trumpet blast, as it says in Isaiah 27:13, in that day a great shofar will be blown, a great trumpet will be blown. And those lost in the land of Assyria, those driven out to the land of Egypt, will come and worship the Lord on the holy mountain at Jerusalem. Apocalypses and eschatological predictions often present a series of mounting calamities. First this, then that, then the next thing, and after that another thing. It's similar to the 10 plagues, you know, the plague of this, the plague of that, the plague of this, the plague of that. And there is sort of a 10 plagues Egypt motif going on here in the book of Revelation. We see a lot of similarities between the calamities of the seven trumpets and the seven bowls and the story of the 10 plagues on Egypt. They borrow a lot of imagery from the story of the 10 plagues on Egypt. At least one other apocalypse, the fragmentary apocalypse of Zephaniah, which is going to be very important as we continue to study. The apocalypse of Zephaniah also features a scene with a sequence of trumpet blasts, which it uses as an organizing principle. And that's what you have going on here. In this case, seven trumpets are given to the seven angels, that is the seven seraphim, which we have seen referred to as the seven spirits of God and the seven torches of fire, the seven stars. Before the angels can begin to blow those trumpets, however, we have to finish the heavenly temple service. So, in verse 3, we come to the end of that half hour of silence, remember? And it says, at the end of the half hour of silence, it says, "And another angel came and stood at the altar with a golden censer, and he was given much incense to offer with the prayers of all the saints on the golden altar before the throne. And the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints rose before God from the hand of the angel." So the temple service on earth is already associates the incense with the prayers, as we've seen. And incense is offered at the daily time of prayer, the daily time of sacrifice, and it symbolizes the prayers going before God. It even says in Psalm 141, "Let my prayer be counted as incense before you." But I don't think that these are just any prayers coming before the Almighty. Instead, I think that these are the prayers of the martyrs, calling on the Lord for retribution and deliverance, calling on God to avenge their blood, such as the petition of the souls under the altar in Revelation 6. At that time, when the fifth seal was opened, they were told to wait a little while longer. Now the wait is over, and their prayers are being received before the Lord. And it says in verse 5, "Then the angel took the censer and filled it with fire from the altar and threw it on the earth, and there were peals of thunder, rumblings, flashes of lightning, and an earthquake." Revelation 8:5. This scene invokes a similar one from the book of Ezekiel, where a voice says to one of the angels, a man clothed in linen, it says, "Go in among the whirling wheels," that is the wheels of the wheel angels, the ophanim of the chariot of God's throne. It says, "Go in among the wheels underneath the cherubim and fill your hands with burning coals from between the cherubim and scatter them over the city." Ezekiel chapter 10 verse 2. The angel does so, and this symbolizes the hot wrath of God falling upon Jerusalem. And there's an interesting Targum on Ezekiel 1:8, where it says, "Under their wings, on their four sides, they had human hands." The Targum says, it explains, "Hands, like the hands of a man, were fashioned for the four living creatures. From beneath their wings, on their four sides, with which they used to take out burning coals of fire from among the cherubim, under the expanse which was over their heads, placing them into the hands of the seraphim, to sprinkle on the place of the wicked, to destroy the sinners who transgress his word." So we see something similar is going on here, something similar to this imagery in Revelation 8:5, where the angel takes the censer and fills it with fire and coals from the altar and throws it down on the earth, symbolizing the beginning of the wrath. And then we hear the sounding of the first trumpet. It says, "Now the seven angels who had the seven trumpets prepared to blow them, the first angel blew his trumpet, and there followed hail and fire mixed with blood, and these were thrown upon the earth. And a third of the earth was burned up, and a third of the trees were burned up, and all the green grass was burned up." So this is the first trumpet. It's reminiscent of Joel chapter 2, verses 30 and 31, which says, "And I will show wonders in heaven and on earth, blood and fire and columns of smoke, and the sun shall be turned to darkness and the moon to blood before the great and awesome day of the Lord comes." The Passover Haggadah uses that same verse from Joel regarding blood, fire, and columns of smoke to introduce as a preface to the recitation of the 10 plagues. And that's similar to the ensuing plagues which are going to strike the earth here in Revelation. But why does it burn up only a third of everything? If you look ahead, the same thing happens with the subsequent trumpets. The second trumpet says, a third of the sea became blood, a third of the living creatures in the sea died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. And then the third trumpet says, a third of the waters became bitter. And the fourth trumpet says, a third of the sun was struck, a third of the moon, a third of the stars, a third of their light was darkened, a third of the day was cut from shining, likewise, a third of the night. So, why the thirds? That's my question. And I think that the reason only a third of everything is decimated with these early trumpets is so that two-thirds will be left for the wrath to be poured out later with the sequence of the seven bowls and so forth. Because if you destroy everything now, the apocalypse is going to be over after only a few trumpets. But why a third? Well, the third, the idea of judgment being divided into thirds, comes from the story of Ezekiel's haircut. You know the story of Ezekiel's haircut? The Lord asked Ezekiel to perform a prophetic sign act in public in front of everyone. So he asked him to do all sorts of crazy things, but this was one of them. One of these prophetic sign acts that Ezekiel was to perform was to shave himself, his hair and his beard, as a prophetic sign. And this was, like I said, this is a public thing, so I imagine he's probably doing it in the marketplace of the Jewish quarter of Tel Aviv, Babylon, where he lives. And here's what it says in Ezekiel chapter 5. The Lord says to him, "Son of man, take a sharp sword. Use it as a barber's razor. Pass it over your head and your beard. Then take balances for weighing and divide the hair. A third part of the hair you shall burn in the fire in the midst of the city when the days of the siege are completed. A third you shall take and strike with the sword all around the city. A third you shall scatter to the wind, and I will unsheathe the sword after them." And the explanation comes about 10 verses later. It says in verse 12, regarding the destruction of Jerusalem, it says, "A third part of you shall die of pestilence and be consumed with famine in your midst. A third part shall fall by the sword all around, and a third part I will scatter to all the winds, and I will unsheathe my sword after them. And thus shall my anger spend itself. I will vent my fury upon them and satisfy myself." So these are an example of judgment being divided into thirds, and that's what's going on here in the book of Revelation, which says a third of this and a third of that. So then the second trumpet sounds. It says in Revelation 8, beginning in verse 8, "The second angel blew his trumpet, and something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea, and a third of the sea became blood, a third of the living creatures in the sea died, a third of the ships were destroyed." To me, this sounds like a description of some type of natural disaster, like I imagined a meteorite striking the earth or something like this, or more likely, a volcanic eruption. Something like a great mountain burning with fire, it says. Well, that sounds like a volcano. And in fact, this prophecy is within the very recent memory of the eruption of Mount Vesuvius, which was an enormous natural disaster in the first century world in Italy, near Rome. It burned and buried, actually, the city of Pompeii, but it also filled the air with ash. It darkened the sun and the stars and the moon. It killed sea creatures. It destroyed ships. So perhaps that's the type of thing in view. Maybe that's a literal a natural disaster that's in view. We don't know exactly how these trumpets will play out and what their actual fulfillment will be, but we can understand the imagery behind them. The third trumpet sounds. It says in verse 10 and 11, "The third angel blew his trumpet, and a great star fell from heaven, blazing like a torch. And it fell on a third of the rivers and on the springs of water. The name of the star is Wormwood, Aspinthos in Greek, La'ana in Hebrew, Wormwood. The name of the star is Wormwood. A third of the waters became Wormwood, and many people died from the water because it had been made bitter. It had been made Wormwood." Wormwood is a type of extremely bitter root, aspinthos, like I said. It also appears in biblical Hebrew, la'ana, where it's used to symbolize punishment for the unrepentant. For example, Deuteronomy 29 speaks of the man who worships other gods and thinks that he will get away with it, that he'll escape punishment, and it refers to him as one who bears gall and wormwood. This is the bitter root, such as it says in the book of Hebrews. See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God, that no root of bitterness, of wormwood, springs up and causes trouble, and by it many become defiled. So the bitter wormwood is a consequence, it's a punishment for sin. Likewise, it says in Jeremiah 9:15, thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I will feed them, this people, with wormwood and give them poisoned water to drink. So there you've got your wormwood and you have your poisoned water. And this verse appears twice in Jeremiah. Likewise, in the book of Lamentations, after the destruction of Jerusalem, it says, he has filled me with bitterness. He has sated me with wormwood. All right, so we understand the imagery, the meaning of the imagery, how it's a punishment, it infers a punishment. It's bitterness. It's a bitter root, a bitter taste. It's left a bitter taste in my mouth. It's a bitter experience. But why is the star from heaven called wormwood? One popular explanation ties this with the meltdown of the Ukrainian nuclear reactor called Chernobyl, which, according to some, is the Russian word, Chernobyl is the Russian word for wormwood. That's not true. That's actually not true. That is not the Russian word for wormwood, despite what you may have heard. I have a different explanation. And I need to ask the question, why is this thing named at all? I mean, the fiery mountain of the second trumpet didn't have a name. Why does this particular star that falls from heaven have a name? Notice that in this description, it says, when the third angel blew his trumpet, a great star fell from heaven, blazing like a torch, and its name is Wormwood. So, it's said to fall from heaven, it's compared to a blazing torch, and we've already seen archangels described as stars, described to be blazing like torches. So I think the natural suggestion here is that this star that falls with a third trumpet is not a meteorite or any natural disaster at all, but rather Aspinthos, wormwood, is the name of a specific angel, an angelic being, an angel of harsh punishment, sent to poison the waters, perhaps. I mean, ironically, ecologically speaking, we're probably well past the point where, due to pollution, one-third of the world's fresh water supply is no longer potable. But I see wormwood not as a natural phenomenon or an environmental disaster, but rather as a spiritual force to be reckoned with, a punishment in the days of tribulation, in the days of wrath. Perhaps a spiritual force behind such environmental disasters, I don't know. But an angelic force, La'ana, wormwood, is an angel of punishment that is cast down to the earth to wreak havoc on the earth. So then the fourth trumpet comes. The fourth angel blows his trumpet in verse 12. And a third of the sun was struck, and a third of the moon, and a third of the stars, so that a third of their light might be darkened, and a third of the day might be kept from shining, and likewise a third of the night. This darkening of the sky is a common apocalyptic sign. And it's easy to imagine how atmospheric dust or ash, such as that thrown up in the air by Mount Vesuvius, might create this phenomenon, I mean, seemingly reducing the light of the heavenly bodies. On the other hand, when striking sun, moon, and stars, there might be an implication of striking at spiritual powers and authorities, angelic principalities represented by heavenly bodies, which is common biblical imagery for the spiritual host of heaven. The stars, the sun, the moon, representing angelic powers. Either way, whether literally or spiritually speaking, it works. And it's hard not to see a pattern here between that, you know, between a sequence in these events of this flaming mountain and then the poisoning of the waters and the darkening of the atmosphere. It's like natural, environmental, ecological results of a calamity such as a large volcanic eruption or something like that. But In any case, we don't know how these things will play out. We don't know what the literal fulfillment will turn out being, but we can understand the imagery behind the various trumpets, the blowing of the trumpets. So this completes the first four trumpets, all of them striking a third of their targets, and the fourth trumpet is followed then immediately by an announcement from an angelic messenger who appears as an eagle flying in mid-heaven. It says, at the end of the chapter, it says, verse 13, "Then I looked, and I heard an eagle crying with a loud voice as it flew directly overhead, 'Woe, woe, woe to those who dwell on earth at the blast of the other trumpets that the three angels are about to blow.'" Why an eagle? Well, in the Roman world, of course, eagles were considered to be omens. The flight path of an eagle was significant, and eagles functioned as messengers of the gods. But also, in the Bible, the eagle is an angelic form of a bird. For example, it says that the cherubim, the chayot, the four living creatures, have four faces, and that one of the four faces of the living creatures is the face of an eagle. So this eagle is saying, "Woe, woe, woe." It's the Hebrew is oi, oi, oi. Oi is an interjection expressing deep sorrow, weighty or grievous announcement, a response to bad news. Woe is me, woe, a woe, pronouncing, the prophets would say, a woe upon Babylon, woe upon Assyria, wherever they were directing their prophecy. The woe is the opposite of the Hebrew ashrei, which we translate as blessed or happy or contented. So, for example, we might say, our master says, "Ashrei, blessed are the poor in spirit. Ashrei, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness." But then, in another passage, he says, "But oi to you who are rich, for you have received your consolation. Oi to you who are full now, for you shall be hungry. Oi to you who laugh now, for you shall mourn and weep." So here's this eagle is announcing these three woes, like the biblical prophets. Oi, oi. And these three woes are things that are yet to come. And these three woes correspond to the three remaining trumpet blasts. We've done four trumpet blasts. And then he says, woe three times. And these three woes are because of the three remaining blasts. So then we find in Revelation 9, verse 12, which comes immediately after the fifth trumpet, it says, "The first woe has passed. Behold, two woes are still to come." And then in Revelation 11, 14, it says, and this which comes immediately after the sixth trumpet, it says, "The second woe has passed. Behold, the third woe is soon to come." And then the third and last woe is not mentioned explicitly in the text, but we may simply assume that it includes then the seventh trumpet. It comes after the seventh trumpet, which includes all seven bowls of wrath and the fall of Babylon, which will be narrated as the vision escalates.
And learn from there, and find rest for your soul.